Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Peichet Amud Aleph, seven lines down. The Gemara here is trying to discuss what is the fundamental machloket between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda and the Mishnah as to when the individual sends with his child money, utensil, in order to purchase something from the Chenvani, and then the Chenvani does exactly that and returns it to him. Why is the Chenvani responsible in that case? The Gemara says, as far as the shemen and the money are concerned, we understand why he is responsible. The question is, that's lochit, the utensil, why is he responsible for that? Because when he sent the utensil with the child, that was an aveda midat. That was something where he basically threw it out, and he doesn't expect to get it back, because when you hand a fragile object to a child of that age, don't expect necessarily that it's going to come back in one piece, or that you're going to get it back. But then why does that make the Chenvani responsible? So the Gemara went through a number of iterations. One was suggesting that the Bala Bayit was a seller of Kederot. The next one, that the Chenvani was a seller of Kederot. And then the Gemara moved on to suggest, no, it was a case where he took it to use it. And since he took it to use it, he became responsible for it. The Gemara says that's still not enough reason to make him responsible. And then we ended up with the answer that we ended off with yesterday, which is, Ubisho'o Shalomidat Kamithlegate. It's a case where he took it, kadon shenata lamud bala acherim. He used it not only to measure out for this child itself, for this individual himself, but he used it to measure out for other parties as well. And the question is, when you borrow something without permission, what is the status of such individual? Mar Savar Shoel Avi. One of them suggests that he is a Shoel, he is a borrower. Mar Savar Gazlan Avi. One of them thinks that he is a thief. Now, the way that the Rashbam explains it over here is, the Mar Savar is the Rabbonon. Rabbonon believe that he is a gazlan. Uknia litchayev be'ay ad shetavod yad balim. And therefore he acquires it and is responsible for it until it's returned to the hand of the balim. Because you need dat balim. You need the balim to be aware of the fact that you've returned it. And when you give it to the tinok, you haven't given it back to the balim. Gzela requires Veshivat Gzela Asher Gazal. And since Veshivat Gzela Asher Gazal is a requirement to return it to the owner himself, when you hand it back to the child, you haven't returned it to the owner. Despite the fact that Gemara in Bava Kamma speaks about a case where one has stolen from a flock of animals and then returns the animal there, if the owner is never aware of the animal leaving and the person replaces the animal in the flock, he doesn't have to let the Balim know. He can just put it back into the corral with the other animals. It's the shita of Rabbi Yochanan there in the Gemara and Baba Kama. So that's what it says. Why don't you say the same thing over here? When he took it, he could just return it to the child. The father never knew it was taken or used, and now he can just return it to the child. That should fulfill his obligation to return it. So the Balei Tosfot say, O Marie, shiny otam. It's a clear difference in the cases. That hata makzira the makoma mishtamer. Over there, he returns it to a secure location. Over here, he's not putting it in a secure location. He's handing it back to the child, which is not secure. And so that's the problem over here. You have a problem of gzela. Gzela requires a return of the object to the party who owns it. And you're not fulfilling that when you hand it back to the child. And that's the sheet of the Chachamim as to why the Chenvani is responsible in this case. On the other hand, the Rabbi Yehuda Savar Shoel Avi, that he is a borrower of the object. If you return it to the place from which you borrowed it, that is sufficient. That exempts you or releases you from the responsibility because you returned it wherever you took it from, because you are considered or classified as a shoel in the interim. That makes it sound like it's perfectly fine. Shoel shalom midat, you borrow without permission. You're called a borrower, so that's fine. If you look in the Rashbam Ikari, he says, Dino ko shoel. He has a din of shoel. Miu isura miha ika. There still is an Easter to do this. It's no different than someone who is a shomer, is a nifkad. Someone was mafkid, deposited with him items. If you're shaleach yad, if you utilize it for your own purposes, it's clear that it is asur. And so too over here. Even if you classify him like a Yehuda as a shoel, that doesn't mean you have permission to do such. Doesn't mean that you didn't violate an isur. But there is a difference when we term you a shoel versus a gazlan as to the level of return that is required. By gazlan, we require you to return it to the original ba'alim and for them to be aware of it. You do not fulfill that obligation when you hand it back to the child. If you're a shoel, you just return it to wherever you got it from. And just like you borrowed it and took it from the child, you can also return it to the child to fulfill your obligation. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda believes that you are patur. Now, the Rabbeinu Gershom, in what is a very difficult understanding of this, reverses the positions and says, Rabbanon Savrei, Shoel, Have, V'nitzchaye Bonseha, that he's classified as a Shoel, and he's fully responsible there, until he hands it back to the owners itself, he is responsible. That's the requirement of a Shoel. Yehuda Savar, Shoel, Shalomidat Gazlan Avi. He's a thief, Ein Lo Din Shoel, Upatur Min Onsin. He's not considered to be a Shoel, and therefore he's Patur Min Onsin, which is very difficult to understand, because a Gazlan is Chayav in Onsin, and a Gazlan, especially if he acquires it and it goes into his possession, it's his. And he still has a requirement of his Shivat Exila Asher Gazal. Doesn't matter what happened to the object in the interim, he can't return the object, he's got to make compensation for it. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says the exact opposite explanation of the Rashbam, but it's very difficult to understand that position of the Rabbeinu Gershom. First of all, why is it by the Shoel that he has to give it back directly to the Baalim? Why can't he return it to wherever he got it from? And number two is by the Gazlan, why he's not Chayav and Onsin is very questionable, because a Gazlan is responsible for the object. But just to note that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains the Gemara exactly in the reverse or the inverse over here. Now obviously then, in the Mishnah, when it says, Umodim Chachamim le Rabbi Yehuda, the Chachamim agree with Rabbi Yehuda when he did it to measure out for the child that it'd be fine. That's even when he takes it out of the child's hand. Even if he takes it out of the child's hand and uses it to measure out the amount that he's giving to this particular customer, that would be fine. Because he's not taking it, he's not borrowing it without permission. He's doing with it what the owner intended, was to use it to measure out what he's going to get and then send it back with the child. So in that case, the Chachamim agree that you're not considered to be a shoel shelo midat. There you are, a shoel midat. Father sent it in order for you to use it for his purposes. When you use it for someone else's purposes, that's where you become a shoel shelo midat. And that's where the Chachamim will agree to Rabbi Yehuda, is where you use it for its intended purpose or why it was sent. And that's why they would agree to Rabbi Yehuda's position in that situation. Now the Rashbam over here brings, in the first wide lines of the Rashbam, Be'itim b'vay shila ha-sugya. Some people explain this entire sugya, the Chenvagiya aragil etzlo, a Chenvani in which he is regular to use, he's a regular customer, Masalo balabait kvarapundion, and the father already gave the money to the Chenvani, v'shalach b'shvila shemen v'isar, and then he went home, and he sent the child to get the change and the produce that he was looking for. And therefore, the only thing he sent with this child was the utensil. If you explain it that way, this whole sugi is a lot easier. The reason that the Rashbam says it's a lot easier is because of the problem we ran into yesterday, which is the Gemara says with regards to tzlochit, the utensil, it's aveda midat. How come it's not an aveda midat with regards to the coin that he sent the child with as well? How come the Gemara only thinks that tzlochit is aveda midat, not the coin? So we saw yesterday the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot who answered that Ein Hachanami, the coin is aveda midat, but once it reaches the hands of the Chenvani and he returns the change, he doesn't hand him back the same object, but he gives him back the change, then the Chenvani is taking a certain amount of responsibility because he did not return the object, did not leave the object in the hands of the Katan. We saw other explanations in the Rishonim, but they're all trying to differentiate between the coin and the Keli, assuming that you think that there is a coin being sent. Remember, we saw Rishonim yesterday say there was no coin that was sent. But here the Rashbam says you can avoid all of this problem by simply saying that the Baal Bayit prepaid for it. He left the money with the Chenvani much earlier. And now the transaction involved is simply him sending his son to get the Shemen plus the change. And that way there's no question about the Pundion. The only question then is about the Tzlochit. The Shemen is clearly the Chenvani's responsibility. The Tzlochit, which is an Aveda Midat, that's where the question arises as to the responsibility of the Chenvani, the Machlokes between the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda. So that's just as a sidebar here, really is more relevant to what we learned yesterday. But over here, the Rashbam gives you an alternate way to read the Mishnah, or the case of the Mishnah, to make it easier to understand or flow through the Gemara. Now, over here, we're speaking about a Shoel Shelo Midat. The sugya appears both in Kiddushin and in Bava Metzia with regards to Mari Bayisak, where he had his sharecropper, and the sharecropper was offering their albonon fruits or items to eat, and whether they accepted or demurred in accepting that gift. Over here, the Gemara explicitly says, Shoal Shalom Idat, and gives us this concept of Shoal Shalom Idat, which whether he is a Gazlan or a Shoal, given what we saw in the Rishbam Ikari, there really is no good outcome from this situation, which is that either you're a Gazlan, or you're a Shoal who's violating an Isur. It's just the question of what Isur you're in violation of. It's not a question if you are in violation of the Isur. The Nebuke Yosef over here in Bava Batra, which has implications, quotes from his Rebbeim, that his Rebbeim said that when it comes to articles of Kiddusha, that there is no problem of Shoel Shalom Idat, because Nechel Elinche, that people are happy to do mitzvot with Mimone. And then he writes afterwards, I do not understand what they are saying. He says, we have Sugyot throughout Shas, where we're speaking about a Sefer Torah, we're speaking about objects of Kedusha, and nowhere does the Gemara suggest that a person is happy to have another individual use his object. If he is a Shomer for the Sefer Torah, there's no indication in the Gemara that it's okay for the Shomer to use the Torah because the person wants the Torah to be used. He wants people to do mitzvot with his Torah. So he says, I don't know where my Rebbeim got it from, and I find stirot to that position throughout Shas, and therefore, I'm not even going to try to defend the position of my Rebbeim. I have to raise my hands and say, I don't understand it, and I really, the Ani Adati, I disagree with it. That it is not permissible to utilize other people's property, even when we're talking about Dvarim Shebekdusha, or even Divrei Mitzvah. So that is the position that Milka Yosef Neged, his Rebbeim, will say that it's fine. We Paskin, like the Rebbeim, in situations or circumstances where the item is located in a place or a location by which one can make assumptions about the owner's permissibility to utilize it. We mentioned this before when we did the Gemara in Bava Metzia with regards to tefillin that people leave in shul. When you leave your tefillin in the shul, you have to have expectations that possibly someone in the shul will utilize the tefillin. That is okay because people want people to do mitzvah with their mimone, but it comes with a qualifier, which is that you have to return it exactly in the same condition and in the same place, in the same way that it was taken, and that you have to return it to exactly the same position, wrapping, and all the other factors that were involved. So that is, also, someone has a sefer when you're in yeshiva and leaves it in the Beit Midrash. If the Beit Midrash has a stated policy, then it's a little easier. Without a stated policy, again, it seems that people are not so makbid. You can read this sefer and then put it back to wherever you found it. If you don't put it back, then it is very problematic. But you have to put it back. Again, today, this is a lot easier in situations where the sfarim today are printed sfarim, and people don't treasure them in the sense that they're so rare or so difficult to get your hands on, versus in their time, when you're talking about a sefer that you're learning from or a Torah, those were things that were unique or very difficult to acquire. And then there might be more akpada with regards to others using the object because of the fact that it's so rare or that it is an item that is so expensive. But today, where we don't have as much of that, then people in general are assumed if they leave it in these public venues to give permission for these items. The other area that we discussed when we discussed the issue of Mari Ba'isak is implicit permission. So implicit permission can be obtained either because of Minhag HaMedina, that is the way that people conduct themselves in this area, and therefore the social protocol in these areas is that people aren't makpid, or people allow you to utilize these items, despite the fact that you have not asked permission. That's what we call implicit permission. There are areas where it's clear that you do not have permission, and if you take it, then you are a gazlan and not a shoel shalom idat. The area of gray is where you have a relationship with the individual. You have a relationship with the individual where you could assume that the person would not be makpid. Had you asked them, then they would probably have given you permission. But you didn't ask them, and therefore you don't have that permission. How much permission can you assume in that situation where you don't have explicit permission, but your assumption is that you would get permission? In that case, is that considered a shol shalom idat? That's where the Rishonim try to draw the lines or figure out where that cutoff is between the area you're called a gazlan an area where it's considered to be socially acceptable to take items. Again, the smaller the value of the item, there again, a shlosh lo midat might be implicitly approved, which is that people aren't makpid. For instance, if you have a matchbox and someone uses one match from your matchbox, you would not necessarily be makpid on such a small item. And it's acceptable to take a match from a matchbox even without permission. Again, if that's the social protocol, then that might be fine. To use the whole matchbox, of course, would be unacceptable. But if you have a relationship with the owner, can it be somewhere between the one match and the entire matchbox? Then you know he would give you permission to use it, but he hasn't given you that explicit permission. Where does that fall along the spectrum of Shoel Shalom Midat? That's really governed by that story in by Mari by Isaac, where the Amoraim are eating from something that's given to them by the worker. How is it that they're eating? How do they know that Mari by Isaac would give permission? And even later on, when he shows up and says to them, oh, klach etzel yafot, why don't you take the better stuff? Why don't you take the best for the chachamim? Over there, the Amoraim indicate that maybe that's not believable. He was too embarrassed to say that he wouldn't have given it. And so you also have to worry about that aspect of it, which is when you borrow something, and the person happens, of course I would have lent it to you, don't worry about it. Is he really telling the truth? Or after the fact, he's too embarrassed to tell you the truth that he wouldn't have lent it to you, or he wouldn't have given you permission. So all of those play into this spectrum of Shoel Shelo Midat. Again, we discussed it more heavily in the Gemara in Baba Metzia as well as in Kiddushin. I'm just noting it again here because here you have an explicit statement of Shoel Shelo Midat. But again, the important aspect is the idea that if you are a Shoel Shelo Midat, you're clearly in violation of something. You're either a Gazlan or you're a violation of a Shoel with an Isur. The only question is, are you not a Shoel Shelo Midat? Can you gain the ability to take it, even though it's Shlomidat, but classify it as Midat? And again, that could happen because of social contract, that could happen because of Nechalei L'Inche, Bavei Mitzvah Ben Mamone, or that could happen because of your relationship with the individual. And so that's what you're trying to figure out is, when are you a Shoel Midat, even though technically the situation is a Shoel Shlomidat. Right, that's just as a small aside to the sugya over here. Then the Gemara now continues as Gufa. We mentioned Shmuel earlier, which is Amar Shmuel, an hotel kli min ha'uman, levakro, someone who takes a utensil from the uman in order to check it out. I mean, he's giving it a test drive, v'ne'anas biyado, something happens even though it was out of his control in his hands, chayav, he is responsible in this case. Bahani mile, that's only true, who, the kitze damel, where the price is known. Now, the price is known, you can have two ways the price can be known. You need to know the price because the seller articulates what he wants, that's the asking price. Or you can have this price be known because the market determines the price. It's something, an object that's out there that everybody sells, and there's a clear and delineated market price to it. The Ramban seems to require an articulation of the price by the seller, whereas many believe that just the market price in and of itself is sufficient grounds for it to be the determinant of price. And the way that the Rishbam in the Perush HaIkari on Kitzei Demeah says, Var katzav upasak tamim kodem shnatalo, either the price was set beforehand, inami kagon kelim ktanim, hanim karim le'olam b'isar, small utensils that are always sold for the same price, b'isar yisar, sheshir shalem yadua, because their price is well known or well accepted in the market. I don't know if that means you went to the dollar store, so you know everything's going to be a dollar, and therefore the price is known beforehand. But there are ways to know or determine the price ahead of time. The reason being is that you can only say that the party who is testing it out really takes responsibility for it when he really thinks he's going to buy it, or that he might buy it. If he doesn't know a price, then he might be too many steps away from actually purchasing it, in order to be willing to accept the responsibility over here. The two ways that we formulated it yesterday and the day before in terms of what is the responsibility, it can either be responsible as a shoel, or it can be responsible as a lokeach. Do we view him as a purchaser with a right of return, or do we view him as a borrower because of kol hana'ah shelo? All the benefit comes to him. That the Rishbam points out over here is based on the sukya in the Darim, that suggests over here that the merchandise being sold is a hot item. It's so hot item that the seller can dictate price, and the buyers are just happy to get their hands on it. In that case, the seller doesn't care if you buy it or someone else buys it, because it's such a hot selling item, he can get it off the shelf no matter what. So when you take it, you're not giving him any benefit when you go to check it out. That means kol hana'ah shelo, the shoel, the individual who is borrowing it in order to test it, all the benefit is to him, which is what the definition of a shoel is where you are the only beneficiary in the transaction. The other party is getting nothing from it. So in that situation, you become responsible for the onsin. That's why the Rashbam explains it over here. He then brings, v'nir b'enai, he says, the Gemara there says that when you return the object, you're considered to be a nosei sachar, you're considered to be a shomer sachar. He says, lab dafka shomer sachar. It doesn't mean literally a shomer sachar. Dimken lo dechayev bonis. Then he wouldn't be chayev in onsin, like Shmuel says, only a big neva of aveda. Time is shum, de kaitzi de meha, bizvina harifahu, ariu benitila, kamo lokeach gamur. It's as if he bought it completely. Inami, kamo shuel, shkoana shelo. So he brings both possibilities of him being a lokeach or a shoel here. It's interesting that the Rashbam says that he can't accept the fact that it's an osi sachar. You could argue against the way that the Rashbam is explaining it here, that it depends where in the stages it is. If he is still testing it out, or if he took it to test it out, in that case he is a shoel or a lokeach, and that's why he's responsible for onsin. Once he decides that he doesn't want it, and now he's returning it to the owner, at that point he might convert into a nosei sechar, which is that it's not that the nosei sechar is describing him in his entirety and his responsibilities, it's just describing what happens when he wants to return it. At that point, he's no longer getting the hana from it. At that point, he's no longer buying it because he intends to return it. What is his responsibility? He might be a nosei sechar. He got the benefit of testing it out. He got the benefit of taking it home. For that benefit, he now is mehaneh. Now he is providing a service of guarding the object and returning it to the original owner. And maybe at that point, he changes into a nosei sechar. And that might answer the problem with the Rashbam over here, even though the Rashbam says he doesn't think that's the case. He thinks he's a shoel or a lokeach through and through, from beginning to end, until he gets it back to the hands of the owner, just throwing out the possibility that you could divide up his responsibilities, and we find that in other places, with regards to objects where an individual, like a shoel, is responsible for the item while he's a shoel. Once the term has ended, and he's passed the time period in which he was entitled to it, and now he's returning it to the balim, over there he does turn into a nosei sechar. So we have precedent for such a concept, that you can be a shoel at some point and then convert into a nosei sechar when your responsibility is to return it and you're past the time period in which you're entitled to use it as a shoel. Haru gabra de alabei dabcho. This individual went into the butcher shop. Agva atmad bisra. And he went ahead and he took a leg of meat, a thigh of meat. Now the way that the Rashbam in the Pirshei Yikra explains over here is, Yerech lirot im shmeinahi v'yeshba basar harbe. Taking a look at it to determine if it has enough fat on it, it has enough meat on it. He's taking a thigh, and he wants to look into the thigh to determine whether this is a meaty enough thigh, or a fat enough thigh, that he wants to purchase it. So that makes it similar to the case of Shmuel, which is that you've taken an object with the intent to buy, but you're checking it out first. You're making sure that it's exactly what you want. Price is already set. And now it's in your hands. Now at the Parsha Mirma Mine, a cavalryman came along and snatched it from him. Onto the Kameh de Rav Yemar, goes to Rav Yemar, who's responsible for this thigh now? It was still the shopkeepers, or does it belong to the individual who was intending to buy it? Chayaveh l'shlumei damah. He obligated the customer to pay the money for it. V'ani milehu d'kizei damah. That's only because the price was fixed, or he knew the price of the object, and he was just checking the object out. What the Gemara is suggesting here is that this is the case of Shmuel. This is the case of Shmuel where the price is set, the individual picks it up with the intent to buy it, assuming that it meets the standards or whatever he is looking for. So he got the benefit now of looking at it. The storekeepers gave him the right to take it and look at it. Even though he hasn't made that final decision to buy it, nevertheless, because he's test driving it, either becomes a shoel or a lokeach with rights of return. If he can't return it, or if it gets taken from him, even in Beones over here, where a thief, or a soldier from the army came along and snatched it away, nevertheless, he's responsible for it, and either he has to pay for it, or return it, and in this case, he can't return it, so therefore he's going to have to pay for it. And that's exactly like this case of Shmuel. How gavra, the aite kare the pumnara. It's another case, this individual brought these gourds to sell in Pumnara. They had a big shipment of gourds they wanted to sell. Brings and puts them out on the market. Ate kul ama shakul kra kra. People were coming and taking. It was a frenzy. People were taking gourd after gourd without him being able to keep track anymore of who's taking what. So now he's in a situation in which the sale is moving too fast and the merchandise has been taken by all these parties and he doesn't know in the end who he's going to collect the money from. He doesn't know who to go after to collect the money. We assume that the people are honest and that they're going to pay him, but nevertheless, people forget. People don't always do it at the right time and he won't be around anymore. He doesn't even know where to go to get the money once they've all disappeared. So he's very frustrated. Amalu, arein muktashim l'shamayim. He's makdish all the gourds over here because he had enough with them. He says, I'm makdish it in order to stop the people from grabbing the gourds or keep the frenzy at bay. He's makdish all of them so that they can't walk off with them without his permission or without first paying for them. So that's the way he dealt with it. In this situation, it's a little harder to understand why it's comparable to the case of Shmuel. Because over here, the buyers aren't necessarily taking the gourd in order to check it out or investigate it. They're taking it because they want to purchase it. Over here, there's no clarity as to what they were checking out. Again, in the case of the Uman, he's checking out the utensil. In the case of the Basar, we said he wanted to check it out. If it was fatty, if it was big enough, it was what he wanted. Over here, we don't see an indication, although in order to have it be a parallel case, you would have assumed that there is something that they're looking at and checking out the gourd, and therefore there's no finality to the sale until they actually pay for it, or they have a right of return, or they're considered to be shoalim, until they pay for it. Atul kameh de Rav Kana, so they went to Rav Kana to adjudicate the case. Amalu, ein adam makdish davar she'eino shelo. Person cannot be makdish something that does not belong to him. If the buyers here are responsible for the item, then they, in essence, are the owners at this point in time. Since they are the owners of it at this point in time, because they're responsible for their own sin, he doesn't have a right to be makdishit. Again, that's only if the price is either set or well known with regards to the object, so there is a conclusion with regards to price discovery. If the price is not set, then they remain in the possession of the original owner, Bishapir Akdish, and therefore he has a right to be Makdishit. So in this case, the question of ownership has to do with the principles that we laid out before. If you're going to take something and you're testing it out, you are responsible for that item, assuming that the price is well understood or well defined. And in that case, you're responsible either because you're Shoel, or because you are a lokeach, a buyer with the right of return. In either case, you're fully responsible for the object, and you either have to pay the individual for it or return it to him. If you can't return it, then you're going to have to pay for it. So that means if something happens to it, you're going to have to pay for the object. Now, in this case, that was the question. Was the price clear, or was the price not clear? If the price was clear, then every individual has the gourd. It's in his possession already, and it's just a question of his right to return it. But he is now in possession of the item. He cannot be makdishit. And the transaction, in essence, is done if he wants to keep it and pay you for it. On the other hand, if the price was not set, and therefore his taking of it was not in the capacity of a shoel or lokeach, but to check it out, but yet, price is yet to be determined, that means he has no intent of buying it until he clarifies the price situation. In that case, it remains in the possession of the original owner. And he would be able to be makdishit. Now, as the Rashbam points out, that is despite the fact that we have a principle from Rabbi Yochanan where he defines, based on the pasuk by Hekdesh, that you need two things in order to be makdish, an object. You need to be the owner, ba'alut, and you need control over the item. You need birshuto. That's to be in your possession in order to be makdish. For that reason, when a thief takes an object from the original owner, neither party can be makdish. The owner can't be makdish because he has no control even though he owns it. Because Lan can't be makdishit because he doesn't own it, even though he's in control of it. They each lack one of those features. The Baal Shvam says, why don't we have the same problem over here with regards to this seller? The seller might be the owner of the object, but he's not in control of the object. The people walked off with the object over here, and so where is his control? The answer he gives is it's different than a Gazlan. Gazlan, when he walks off the object, there's no intent to return the object. That's why you have no control over the object, is because your ownership exists, but your control is gone because the gazlan or ganav determines what's going to happen to this object. On the other hand, when these people are taking it from him, they're not intending to steal it. They are intending either to pay for it or return it to him. And therefore, it does remain in your control because these people aren't intending to take it out of your control. They're simply trying to purchase it for themselves. They have an ability to return it. And therefore, they do not intend for you to lose control over here. They simply want to purchase the item. Given that, the Rashbam says you qualify to be both considered the owner and the controller of the object over here if there was no fixed price that was set. And therefore, you could be makdish, the object, even though it's technically out of your control right now. And the Rashbam says, I can give you an example of that. If you're mafkid, if you deposit an object with another party and then you want to be makdishit, nobody says you can't be makdishit because the person watching it for you or taking the deposit is not present over here, is not in front of you, and is not in your control. But no, that's not the case. You're allowed to be makdishit because you're the owner and you control it. Someone else is helping you out to watch it. That doesn't detract from your control of the object. And similarly over here, that's exactly what's happening over here. It's as if the object's deposited with these individuals, and that doesn't belie a lack of control. All right, Tanur Banan. Lokeach yarek min hashuk, ubier ve'aniach. Person is purchasing vegetables in the marketplace, and ubier ve'aniach. He is choosing and putting them down. Here you can see in the Rishbam Ha'ikari, the case here is a situation, lo shegamar liknot. He hasn't come to the conclusion that he's going to buy it. Elo lirot et ativot. He's looking at the condition of the vegetables. He's looking at the quality of the individuals. V'achakach yikach ma sheyirtzeh. And afterwards, he will buy whatever it is that he determines. He's setting aside. He is picking out the best of the vegetables. But he has yet to make up his mind with regards to purchasing of the item. So he's making efforts to put together a pool of produce that he was going to buy. But he has to determine he's going to buy it, if he's going to find enough, he's going to find good enough, whatever the quality is, but he is going through the process now of picking it out and checking the quality of the item. The Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, says, Madad Chavilachat, he checks out, or he weighs, or counts, the one bundle, Beiniach Chachat, and then he puts one down, Afilu Kola Yom Kulo, even if he does that all day, he doesn't know which one he's going to buy. In that case, you're not kone, you're not responsible for the maser. So the Rabbeinu Gershom says, bier ve'niach simply means that you are picking them up and measuring or looking, counting them out, but you have yet to make a decision as to whether you're going to purchase it. And you can do this all day long. You can be looking through merchandise, but until you make the decision to purchase it, you're not responsible for it. The way that the Rashbam suggests over here is that you are setting aside certain produce which you think is good enough quality, but you have yet to make that determination or come to the conclusion that you're going to purchase the object. Even if you do this all day, you're not koneh. And you're not responsible to take off shumot masrot. The obligation to take off shumot masrot is triggered by ownership, by your buying or taking possession of the item. Once you take possession of the item, you become responsible for the trumot masrot. Here, since you don't take possession of it, you are not responsible for the item, and you're also not chayav in trumot masrot. Gamar bilibolok noto kana. If in his heart he decides to buy it, he is koneh v'nit chayav b'maser, and is responsible for the maser. And now the Gemara deals with the dilemma that he's faced with. The assumption here is this is a chaver who's buying from an Am Haaretz. The Am Haaretz, we aren't certain as to whether he took off Trumot Masrot. Therefore, the chaver who buys it has to be Mafrish Trumot Masrot Bidmai. And the mechanism of Demai, which is involves how do you deal with a safek, whether it was Musar or not Musar, and how do you take off from that Trumot Masrot. So now, the problem is that he took it and intended to buy it. And his intent to buy it now makes him responsible for the object, not to allow an object to leave his possession that doesn't have trumot or masrot taken off of it. So now he has a problem. Lachziro yafshar. He can't return it to the Am Haaretz without doing anything. Shekvar nitchayev b'maser. He's responsible for the maser. Uli asro yafshar. And to take off the trumot or masrot he can't do. Shvar mafchitan bin damim. Because then he hands back to the Am Haaretz less than the Am Haaretz gave him. He's my face, Trumot Masrot, he's going to be handing back less produce than he actually was given in the first place, because he's going to be take off the Trumot HaMasrot. And the Amharis isn't going to accept that. He's not going to accept getting back 90% of what he handed him, or whatever the percentage is, after you've taken off the Trumot and Masrot. So HaKetzat, what do you do in this situation? Masro, benotein lo dmei maser. What he does is he takes off the Masrot, and then he hands him back the equivalent value in money for that which he separated away from the produce that he took from the Amharis. My says, Atu mishum de gamar b'libolik note. Just because in your heart you decide you're going to buy something, kana, and it's chayev b'maser, you require it, then you become chayev b'maser. Where do you ever find such a concept that gemirat aleiv can trigger the necessity to take off trumot and masrot, or the responsibility of being koneh such an object? Simplest way to understand this is that we don't find people's thoughts obligating them with regards to kinyanim. So what's going on over here? The way that the Rabbeinu Gershom explains it over here is, afa bish lo igbia adayin. You're lacking any kinyan over here. You're lacking the kinyan hagbah over here. Where is the kinyan in order that your thoughts should impact? You might have the thoughts, but you have no physical kinyan that is taking place. Since when does your thoughts have any impact on a transaction or a situation? Again, the simpler way to say it might be to say that
is yes, that you are responsible for the object in this case because you took it to test it out, but that doesn't give you full ownership over here. You have a right of return. And so yes, you might be a lokeach with a right of return or a shoel, but why should that be mechayev you in maaser? You don't have enough ownership yet to be chayav in maaser. You have ownership for responsibility vis-a-vis onsin, but you don't necessarily have ownership to make you chayav in maaser. And even with a Kenyan Hogbah in this case, it will not be sufficient to generate the ownership that should be mechayev you.
Now, as far as v'nit chayev b'maser, you're chayev to take off the masrot, what we're speaking about here, the way that the Rashbam in the Pirshei Ikari says, is v'notein lo levi ul'aniim v'notein lo dmei maser. When he takes off the maser and he hands him back the money equivalent of what he took off, he gives the maser rishon to the levi, or the maser ani to the ani. He's responsible to take off masrot from it and give it to the recipient and pay the individual, the Amharis, the compensation for whatever he took off so that he's not chaser when he returns it to him. The Balei Tosafot already point out, but that's a very difficult Rashbam. The Rashbam here is saying that you give the Maaser Rishon to the Levi, the Maaser Ani to the Ani. When you take off Trumot and Masrot Demai, Hamotzi Michabero Alav Araya. And since we don't know for sure if you're Chayav in Trumot and Masrot over here, there is no responsibility to give the item to the other party. He has to come and prove that you are obligated to pay him. By the Truma Gedola, we say that Rov Amei Aretz are taking off from being Mafrish Truma Gedola, and therefore there's nothing to deal with. Demai then deals with everything afterwards. As far as Maaser Rishon is concerned, and Maaser Ani, you have to be Mafrish those items, but you don't have to give it to the recipient, because the recipient has to prove to you that you're really Chayav over here. The burden of proof is on him, because there is a Safek. That means all you have to do is be mafrish them and then leave them there. They're chulin, maaser ani, and maaser rishon are chulin that zarim can eat, and therefore there's nothing to do with them. On the other hand, maaser rishon, taking off the trumat maaser from that, that you have to give to the kohen, or that you have to dispose of properly because there's a chiyuv mita bidei shemayim associated with that. So the Balei Tosafot in the end suggests that that's either the case here is where you're dealing with the trumat maaser, or you're dealing with maaser sheni. And in Maaser Sheni, you can't simply be Mafris to Maaser Sheni. You have to be Podeh. You have to redeem it and then take the monies up to Yerushalayim to utilize the monies in Yerushalayim. So that's where we're talking about a Chisaron. The Chisaron is all involved with Maaser Sheni and Trumat Maaser. Maaser Rishon and Maaser Ani are not items that you're going to lose the produce. Even if you Mafris them and hand it back to the Amharis, you've done nothing wrong. Because Amotzi Michavero Alav Araya. That's just with regards to what he has to separate over here. The Gemara's question is still outstanding, and the Gemara says, yes, here we're dealing with people who are not acting in the letter of the law, but rather, they are looking at the spirit of the law, they're looking at commitment being something that a person has to stand by, whatever their commitment is, even if they have not articulated it, even if they haven't verbalized it, they've thought it in their own mind, that is a maila to stand by your thoughts. Obviously, it doesn't mean anytime you think something, you have to stand by your thoughts. It means in the context of an interaction where you could interpret your actions as either being that you're buying it or that you're not buying it. If in your heart you decided you wanted to buy it, we will give that interpretation to your action and assume that you were a konet. That's only true. People are Yirei Shamayim. People do things lifnei mishurat hadin. An example of this is Rav Safra, the Kain ben Afshay. The Rav Safra, he held himself to the following standard. Dover emet bilvavo. Someone who speaks the truth in his heart. In that which is in his heart, he carries out or is truthful about what his thoughts were, his intent was in these situations. Since his intent was to buy it, he becomes responsible because of that intention. Even though in the letter of the law, you're not responsible for intentions, only for either articulation or a ma'aseh. The case by Rav Safra is a situation in which he was davening Kriyat Shema, and he had some merchandise and produce to sell, which was in demand. Someone came and made an offer to him to purchase the item, and Rav Safra did not respond to him. Didn't respond to him because he was in the middle of Kriyat Shema, and it was inappropriate for him to respond. The individual thought he was giving him the silent treatment because he wasn't paying him enough. So he raised the price, and then he raised the price again, and he kept raising the price while Rav Safra is saying Kriyat Shema because Rav Safra is not responding. When Rav Safra finishes Kriyat Shema, according to the Rambam, where it says when he finishes Tefillah, maybe that he finished Shemot Esrei as well, he turns to the individual that's trying to buy it from him. At that point, he's responding. The buyer thinks, that's the price. I got to a price where he's willing to do it. Rav Safra says, no. In my mind, I already sold it to you. I agreed to you when you told me the first price. I couldn't say anything because I was in Kriyat Shema, but that was my intent. Even though you raised the price after the fact and you were willing to pay more, I'm not going to accept that excess amount because that came from a misunderstanding, not from what I would have been happy to take from you. Since I would have been happy to take from you the first price you offered, I'm going to sell it to you at that price. So he's standing by his heart, which means that he, in his mind, sold the item. And since in his mind he sold the item, he stood by that, even though the buyer was willing to pay more, thought that he would need to pay more in order to acquire it. That's what the Gemara says over here. We're speaking about Yirei Shamayim of that caliber and of that conduct. And that's why over here, when they think about buying something from the Am Haaretz, even though they've never articulated, never done anything to show that they bought it, but if in their mind they are intending to buy it, that already makes them responsible for the item to take off the Trumot to Masrot. And that's why we run into the problem of handing it back to the Am Haaretz. You can't hand it back to them without taking off the Trumot to Masrot because you're responsible for it now. But you also, if you're mafish the Trumot Masrot, you can't give him back less than he handed you. And that's why you have to be mafrish, whatever you have to be mafrish, and replace it with monetary compensation to the seller who is in Am Haaretz. Right. The next Mishnah, Hasiton. Hasiton seems to be a wholesaler. The way that the Rashbam translated is, Chitim Lashon Yavan. It's a Greek word for wheat or produce. And therefore, he's a siton, is called this because of the fact that he is a large transactor in these items. The way that the Mesorah Tashas brings from the Perish siton, hu mocher davar lach. Someone sells liquid items, dano yayin b'shemen. That's one possibility that he brings in the name of the Tosafot. And he brings from the Rambam, Perish siton, hu amocher ma'achalim rabim b'midagasa. Someone sells a cadre of products, but he sells them in large quantities. So again, he is a wholesaler, and he buys from the farmers, and then turns them over and sells them to the retailers in smaller quantities. Mikaneach midotav echad l'shloshim yom. He has to clean off his measurements, his weights, once every 30 days. Ubalabayit echad l'shneimasar chodesh. A balabayit, someone who is not a professional, but sells from his own produce or his own items, he only has to clean them up once every 12 months. Seemingly, the difference between them is the frequency of usage, which is that the chenvani, the seiton, who is doing this on a regular basis, has more buildup of whatever it is that he is measuring, and that buildup causes the weighing process to be inaccurate, and therefore he has to wash down or wipe down the midot so that he continues to give accurate measures. The balabayit, who's doing less of this, has less requirement in terms of wiping down the midot. And the Gemara is going to qualify this and tell us that it's talking about liquid measurements. And the fear here is that the liquid measurements will nikrash, coagulate in the weight or on the weight or in the scale. And so because of that, you need to wipe it out or wash it out so that it doesn't become a skew or an inaccuracy in the weighing. Dry items don't have that problem. You can dump them out and there's no residue or residual left. And therefore, you're not going to have to wipe them down or clean them off with this type of frequency. And again, the Sitton, who's doing heavy transactions, he needs to do this more often, versus the Balabayit, who's doing this more infrequently, he only has to do it on a more infrequent basis. Rav Shimon Gamliel omer chiluf advarim. It's just the opposite. Now, what's interesting over here is the Rabbeinu Gershom says, or brings a possibility, that the chiluf advarim over here means literally the opposite, which is Balabayit hu ashir. The Baal Bayit is wealthy, v'yeshlo yoter limdod. And therefore, he measures more. So what he says is that Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel is arguing on the facts as to who sells more quantity or who is the one using their measurements more. The way that the Tanna Kamma says it is that the Sitton is doing more business or transacting than the Baal Bayit. On the other hand, the Rabbeinu Gershom suggests that Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, when he says chiluf tvarim, is saying just the opposite. The Baal Bayit does more measuring because he sells much larger quantities in one shot. Therefore, he has to do more measuring. Whereas the Sitton is selling in smaller measures, and he only has to measure on a less frequent basis. The Rashbam in the Perusha Ikari rejects that. He says, v'igadam, right? He quotes the Rabbeinu Gershom's pshat, chiluf tvarim b'shvilos ha-Sitton enu mocher tadir ke-Baal Bayit. Velo nehira. It's like a good brisker. He says that can't be the case. To be milta de kachazinan eze mocher tadir yoter michaviro b'halo plige. The chachamim, the tanaim, don't argue about facts. It's a fact. Go out and figure out what the fact is. You can go and do a survey. You can find out what the information is. We don't argue about facts. Aval b'tamei davar plige could depreciate. They argue about the reason behind it. There has to be a logical argument over here, not an argument over facts. The facts are the facts. The facts are that the Sitton sells more than the Baal Bayit. The question is, what is the implication of that? And therefore, the way that Rashbam in the Pirushai Kari explains over here is that the difference between Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Tanna Kamma is, the Tanna Kamma says, the more frequently you use them, the more you have to wipe them down. Rav Shimon Gamliel says, that logic is reversed. It's wrong. The more you use them, the less likely it is to coagulate because you're always having liquid flowing through there and taking it in, putting it out. Given that, you don't have to worry about it coagulating or causing a problem. The Baal Bayit is using it more infrequently. He will have time in which the liquid could dry in there and cause a weight issue. And that's the way the Rashbam explains the machloket over here. It's not a practical machloket, but a machloket about the logic as to whether frequency makes it more likely that you need to wipe it down, or less likely that you need to wipe it down. And that's the difference between Rav Shimon Gamliel and the Tanna Kamma. Chen bani mikaneach midotav pamayim b'shabbat. A storekeeper has to wipe down his midot twice a week. So now, the question here to start with is, according to whom is this being said? The way that many read it is, that this is, and that's the way that the Rabbeinu Gershom reads it is, this is atan the Tanna Kamma. This is according to the Tanna Kamma. According to the Tanna Kamma, who said that frequency is what makes you have to wipe your measurements down more frequently. Then over here too, the Chenvani, Shechol Yom Vayom Modeit, he checks every single day, then he has to now wipe it down on a more frequent basis. And that is, this is a continuation of the position of the Tanna Kamma. According to the Rabbeinu Gershom, technically it could be according to either party. Because he says, the way that he explained the machlok between Rav Shimon and the Tanna Kamma was, are arguing about who is more frequent a user over here. And then in this case, then again, the more frequent user has to wipe it down more. It could even be a divrei hakol. But according to those that think that the machlok here is in reason or in logic, there are those that want to suggest that it is, this din of the Chenvani is only according to the Tanna Kamma. On the other hand, the Rashbam says, Veloni Hira. I don't think that's the correct way to explain it. We have a principle that the halacha is always like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel when he appears in a Mishnah. The halacha is going to be like Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. That means that the remainder of the Mishnah, which is now following the Tanna Kamma, is not going to be the halacha. My Rebbeim explained it that way. And I'm not happy with that. Number one, because then the halacha is going to be against this part of the Mishnah. And in addition to that, I think Rabbi Shimon Gamliel does not object to this statement of the Mishnah. And even though Rabbi Shimon Gamliel believes the more frequently you use it, the less need there is to clean it, over here he'll make an exception. And that exception derives from the fact that the Mishnah before told us that a chenvani does not have to pour out the last three drops. That is, other people have to pour out the last three drops from the barrel or the measurement in order to finish the sale and to give it to the buyer. The chenvani, most likely because of his volume of customers, can't take the time to do that, and therefore the buyers are mochel on it. But that means that his utensils are collecting more and more inside of them because he's not dripping them out. He's not letting it go. That means over time there's a buildup inside of his kelim because of the fact that he's not pouring out those three tipim. And that's what is meant over here, and that could be according to both the Tanna Kamma and Rabbi Shimon Gamliel. Because here, frequency is not the issue at hand. It's the fact that the frequency of his measurement doesn't need to be drained out each time. And since it's not being drained out each time, there's a buildup inside of the kli, and that's why he has to wash it off twice a week. And he's got to wipe down his weights once a week. Now over here, we're talking about not the item that's holding the liquid in it, but rather the weights that are used to measure, and the way the Rishbam says it, basar and davar lach. Again, liquid items, then he has to wipe them down. If you're actually using a scale, you need to wipe down the scale every time you're going to weigh something in the scale, because there, each time there's stuff that's left in the receptacles of the scale, you need to wipe it down in order to clear it out. Amar Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Bamed Dvarim Amurim. This mission is all qualified by the fact that this is Balach. We're talking about liquid measurements, or measurements that involve fat or other things that can rub off on the weights or on the scale. Aval B'Yavesh, when it comes to dry goods, Enu Chayav. He's not obligated to wipe the items down, because in the example that he gives over here are Peirot U'Pilpalim, Kimon. Items that are individual, that you dump them out, and they all come out. You take peppers out, all the peppers leave the utensil. You take out the peirot, the fruits, they're all emptied out. Therefore, he doesn't have to wipe it down, because there's no residue or residual left. That would mean in certain items, like powdery items that you're selling, where when you dump it out, there's still a residue that's left behind, they may be the same as the barlach here, even though they are technically yavesh. V'chayev l'achriya lo tefach. When he uses the moznayim, he has to give a tefach worth of extra to the buyer. Generally, when you use a scale, the objective is to get the scale to be even or flat. Yet, over here, there's a requirement in the Mishnah, and the Gemara will discuss why, to be machriya tefach, to give a tefach, to have it weigh more heavily on the buyer's side, a tefach. So you have to give him more than the weight of what you're selling him. The question as to why you have to do that is brought in the Gemara. It's brought in the Gemara, though the Rabbeinu Gershom over here suggests the reason being the Gabei Ochel Nefesh Mipnei Sheyesh Bo Psolet. That this is talking about food items which have refuse or discard associated with them. When you go to the store and you buy fruits, you buy vegetables that have a peel on them, have a skin on them, when they weigh them for you, they weigh them with the skin or with the peel on them. You're not really buying the fruit, you're ending up buying a lot of stuff that is not useful. Most of the Rishonim explain it here, that this is b'makom shenagu. That is the minag ha-makom. That was the customary way to weigh things. If that's the customary way to weigh things, then you have to give a tefach towards the buyer. The Rabbeinu Gershom is explaining the reason behind that, or the logic behind why you would do such a thing or have such a practice, but it seems to be that that was the practice. The Rashbam over here says, "V'nir beinayid levchod militra lo bayechrei tefach." That once you get below a certain minimum measurement of a litra, there's no longer requirement of tefach. The nafish yoter midayechrei tefach b'davar kal. You deal with very light items to have it weigh down a tefach towards the side of the buyer is a huge excess amount that you are giving in order for that to be the case. So he says that you have to have at least a minimum size by which the hakrat tefach would be a reasonable percentage addition to the item. There are other Rishonim that disagree with that and say that there is no such minimum. And they argue that a tefach worth of having the scale weigh towards the buyer's side will always be the same percentage of the weight, which is the lighter the item, the lighter the counterweight, and therefore it will take less of that item to bring it down a tefach. The heavier the item, the heavier the counterweights are, and therefore it will take more of that item to have it weigh down. And they claim that if you use the same tefach every time, you'll end up with the same percentage increase in the produce that's being given to the buyer. And over here, it doesn't seem like the Mishnah makes a distinction between Davar Lach and Davar Yavesh. This requirement seems to be across the board. Shokel lo ayin ba'ayin, if he weighs it for him exactly, ayin ba'ayin means either that you can see level across, or like the eyes of an individual are level across, or the expression of ayin ayin is eye to eye, meaning that level, at face, panim to panim. And it means here that he's going to measure it exactly. Notein lo girumim. He has to give him some excess or some bonus. The Gemara will set this up in a place where they don't have the minhag to be machriya tefach. So then when you're weighing it or you're measuring it on an exactitude, you still have to be machriya. You still have to give the buyer an additional amount. Achad asara bilach. That is 1/10 by lach. Vechad esrim biyavesh. And 1/20 in dry measurements. The Gemara will tell us that the 1/10 over here is not really 1/10. It's 1/10 of 10 times the amount, or in essence, it is 1%. And then the Gemara will then discuss what the percentage is when it comes to the Yavesh, when it says, Ve'echad yesrim. Makom shenagud amud bidaka, lo yamud bidgatsa. In a place where they normally measure out items as individual or smaller units, you can't aggregate them and measure out in a block. Bigasa, in an area where they do it in a full measure, meaning that they do all the weight together, lo yamod bidaka, then you can't measure it out on a smaller quantity basis, adding up to the total amount. The argument is either that the weights, you're going to use the smaller weights, in the end they just don't add up to the total of the bigger weight, and so depending in which direction you're going, it'll be to the benefit of the koneh, the buyer or the mocher, and therefore you have to keep the practice, or whatever the common practice is, of the locale, or the way that the Rashbam expresses it over here is the next piece of the Mishnah, which is limchok lo yigdosh. If when they sell items in this place, they wipe off the top and they do not heap it on top, then you can't do that. Ligdosh, the place where they do leave the heaping above whatever utensil it is in, then you lo yimchok, you can't wipe off the top. And what he suggests over here is if it's a place where they are wiping off the top, then, depending on how many times you weigh it, it will make a difference. If you only weigh it in one big quantity and you wipe off the top, that'll give you a different amount of loss from wiping off the top than when you do it in multiple measurements and wiping it off each time. And again, sometimes to the benefit of the buyer or the seller, depending on which direction you are going. So the Rashbam says the problem is that you're going to repeat a behavior which will have different results if you do it only once or if you do it multiple times. The Rabbeinu Gershom suggests over here that the problem is, the problem that we've been dealing with all along, which is that some of the item, when you measure it, sticks to the kli. And so if you measure it multiple times, you're going to get more stickiness and more left behind versus if you do it one time, where you would have less left behind because it only went through the utensil one time. Now, based on the Rabbeinu Gershom's explanation, you can also understand why there might be a difference between lach and yavesh, which is that the lach gets stuck in the kli much more heavily than the yavesh, and that's why you have to give a greater hachra'ah for the liquid, the lach, than you do have for the yavesh. And he adds on that the issue of hachra'ah that you have to do each time in a place where you have the minhag to be machriya atefach, you can never get that exactly right. And therefore, if you increase the number of hachra'ot, he's going to end up benefiting more times if you do it multiple times versus if you do it in one shot. So for all these reasons, whatever the practice of the place is, one must abide by those practices and not change from them, because there are implications to changing, even though supposedly you're doing some sort of exact, quote-unquote, measurement. Nevertheless, it never turns out to be exact. And because of that, you have to abide by the practices of the locale and not deviate from them, because in deviating from them, you're going to cause inaccuracies or benefits to either the buyer or seller or detriments to the buyer or seller, and that we don't want to happen. So Gemara says, Menahane Mile. Where do we know this requirement that the Mishnah says that chayav l'achriya tefach? Where do we know that from? Amar Reish Lakish, Amar Kral, the pasuk says, Evin shlema vatzedek. You have to use weights that are whole and that are just. And now the Gemara darshins from vatzedek, which the Rashbam claims over here is extraneous language, because the pasuk already tells you you have to use a full and proper weight. So then what is vatzedek? Tzedek mishalcha b'teino. Give some of what is yours and give to him. Iochi a masefa. Then what are you going to do with the latter part? The Mishnah says, a shokelo ayin ba'ayin. Then he's giving him or weighing for him equally. Notein lo girumim. Then he has to add on an additional percentage. V'achra'a doraita echiv le ayin ba'ayin. If the achra is a requirement min haTorah, how does he wait till later in order to do this? What the Rosh Hashanah and the Perush HaIkari suggests over here is that by Isura Kovid, then he's violating the Isur, Afopi, Shemishalim Lo, Basof, even though in the end he adds on some from his own value to give to the buyer, the Mishashu Modeid Bein and Sadek Mishalcha. The requirement for the Torah means while you're weighing it, you need to make the Machra in the weighing, you have to do it at that point in time. And therefore, even though in the end you are giving more of your own to him, that doesn't suffice if the requirement d'oraita is at the point of hachra'a, the point of the scale, you must do that tefach, you must do more, then the latter half of the Mishnah, you're not accomplishing it, even if you're giving some more of your own. If the hachra, the requirement of this hachra is a Torah principle, how can you wait until later to do the tzadik mishalcha and not do it at the moment of hachra'a? El reisha b'makom shinagu. The reisha is telling you that is the practice of the location. If the practice of location is such, then you have to do it in that manner. V'chi itmar de Reish Lakish a seifa. Itmar, Reish Lakish's din is set on the seifa, which is that the requirement d'oraita is that you give more. Not at the time of weighing, but at the time that you're giving it to the buyer, you must give him an additional percentage. And the Mishnah is telling you that the minhag, if you do this, hachra at the time of the weighing, is a hachra tefach, but the requirement d'oraita is only to give a little more in the end. Brings us a conclusion, which basically wraps up what we said until now, which is, Yeshokelu Ayin Bayin, when he's weighing it for him on a level plane, Notein lo Girumim. He has to give him the additional Girumim, Menahani Mile. Where do we know this from? I'm Rishokesh Damakrab, Vatzedek, Tzedek Mishokha, Vatein lo. So here you have the source for the latter part of the Mishnah of Girumim, implying that the earlier part of the Achrat Tefach is only an issue of Minhag. Their way of doing this tzedek meshelcha is to do it at the time of hachra with the hachra tefach, although the requirement d'oraita is only to do it in the end, that you give him more. And the purpose of this girumim might be to ensure the tzedek, that you actually come to the right measurement. Meaning that there's always a risk that you're off in your measurements. So if you are machria, if you give a little more to the buyer, in that case you're certain that you haven't cheated the buyer. And that's a way to make sure that it is tzedek. It's tzedek mishalcha. Give a little more of your own in order to ensure that the buyer gets exactly what he wants. If he gets more, fine, but at least you gave him exactly what he wanted. Again, as we mentioned before, the Beit Gershom sees it as being more of a practical issue, which is the psolet that comes with the ochel nefesh. This is a way to deal with that psolet. He says that by the achrat tefach. I'm assuming that he would say the same thing over here by the girumim, mida oraita, which have a lower percentage. V'kama girumim, this excess or this bonus that you're giving to the buyer, how much is it? Amrav Yibav Mamel, Amrav, echad me'asara belitra, belach be'asara litrin. He says that it is 1/10 of a litra in liquid measurements, l'asara litrin, when you have 10 litrin. So over here, the way that the Rashbam and the Rishonim read it, based on the Gemara that's upcoming, is that this means 1/10 of a tenth. So it's 1/10 of a tenth, which in essence is 1% of the item you have to give a bonus for. Both the Rashbam and the Balei Tosafot indicate that the Gemara is being medayek this from the Mishnah, that even though the Mishnah says achad le'asara, the fact is it doesn't say achad me'asara, one from 10, but rather achad le'asara, one for every 10, and therefore they see that language indicating that there should be another asara there. And given that, that's how the Gemara comes to this conclusion, that it really means 1% and not 1/10. Although the Rosh Mishantz And the Tosafot over here says there's an implication to saying it this way. Why not just say 1% instead of saying achat la'asara? So the Bali Tosafot suggests that it would have just been confusing in the Mishnah to say achat la'asara la'asara. But then why not just say achat mimeyo? So the answer is, according to the Rosh Mishnah, is that this has normative implications, which is this requirement d'oraita only applies when you're measuring asara litrin. Ava pachot mikan, less than that, enu chayav midoraita. You're not chayav to do this girumim midoraita. And even though the Gemara later on says that he's using measurements that are less than 10, and yet still doing this hachra'a, that he says is because, hani milei gabi hachra'a, talav doraita, uba makom shenagu. That is a hachra'a in a place that has the minhag to do such, even though it's not a din d'oraita. Others suggest that even if there's no din d'oraita, there might still be a din d'rabbanan of girumim, and that will have implications when you have a safek. In the cases of safek, if it's only d'rabbanan, you'd go the kula. If it's d'oraita, you would go the chumra. So even if you believe that girumim has a threshold midoraita, then below that, they still might be chayav midrabbanan. The difference would be if you have a safek, below that amount, you go to the kula. Above that amount, you go to the chumra. There's some that even say that the whole issue of the measurements here is midrabbanan. The requirement midoraita is girumim. The chamim established what the thresholds are, what the measurements are, and that's all midrabbanan. Midoraita, you need a koshu, and you would have satisfied the din doraita. And the Gemara asks now, echad asara belach, vechad esrim biyavesh. Ibailu, heichi kamar. What is meant by the Mishnah? Now that you're reading the Mishnah, not to mean one-tenth, but achad me'asara le'asara, one-tenth out of tenth, which would be 1%. How does that apply to the next line of the Mishnah, which is that 1/20th by Davar Yavesh? Echad me'asara belach le'asara delach. The 1/10th by the liquid measurements is out of 1/10th, meaning 1%. Ve'echad me'asarim biyavesh le'asarim diyavesh. And similarly, by the dry measurements, it'll be 1/20th of 1/20th, or 0.25% of the total amount. Odilma, echad me'asara le'asara delach. Or maybe you would say it this way, it's 1/10th of 1/10th for Davar Lach. Ule esrim diyavesh, and similarly 1/20th for the dry goods. I mean that the 1/10th here is modifying both of them. Do you say it's 1/10th of 1/10th, and then by yavesh it's 1/20th of 1/20th? Or do you say it's 1/10th times a tenth for the lach, and times 1/20th for the yavesh? Or in essence, you would be giving a 0.5% instead of 0.25% by the yavesh. Gemara leaves it as a teiku. They're uncertain as to how to read the Mishnah, whether the extra asara is only modifying the 1/10th because it's using the same measurement and multiplying it, which is 1/10th of 1/10th. And if you did it that way, you would do the next thing, 1/20th of 1/20th. Or is the 1/10th the given? That it's 1/10th of 1/10th, and then the next one is 1/20th of 1/10th. The difference being that by Davar Lach, you'd always get 1% as being the Girumim. By the Davar Yavesh, according to the way that you read it, it's 1/20th of 1/20th, you'd give 0.25%. If it is 1/20th of 1/10th, then you'd be giving 0.5% or 50 basis points excess by the Yavesh. The Gemara leaves this as unresolved. That's what I mentioned before. Whether you think this din is a din d'rabbanan or d'oraita, that would maybe to be determinant as to whether you go the chumra or the kula over here. Or otherwise, if you don't have that, then you go by the principles throughout Shas, which is whenever you have a teiku in mamon, samotzimi chavero alav araya, and therefore you would have to go with the lower percentage, which is the 0.25%, and not the 0.5%. Amar Ablevi, kasha unchan shel midot yoter miunchan shel arayot. That more severe is the punishment for someone who cheats in measurements more than someone who cheats, quote unquote, with illicit relationships. So zen emar ben el, because by the one of them it says el, bezen emar ben ela, and the other one it says ela, which is that by the arayot it says eta toevota el, you may not partake or be involved in any of these disgusting items. By midot, it says, kolose eile, kolose avel. So there it uses the term eile. And the Rashbam indicates that the letter hey is indicative of something that has more severity involved with it. The Marsha indicates that the hey is representative of what the Gemara says in other places, that hey is the letter that Hashem created this world with. And that's to show you that the bottom is open. It's very easy to sin and to fall out. But tshuva, that little hole on the top where the leg of the hay doesn't meet the roof of the hay, that's the area for people to climb back in and to do tshuva, which is very difficult. And so hay is representative of this idea that it's easy to make a mistake or to fail, but it's much harder to do tshuva. And the addition of the hay by the midot is indicative of this fact that it's much harder to do tshuva for it, and it's a temptation that many people fall into. The Maharal over here compares the two in the following manner, saying that both of them involve delineations, limitations, or lines, which is that arayot define or delineate which individuals you are permitted to marry or to engage with, and which individuals you are not permitted to engage with. Measurements, in the same way, are, in a more exacting manner, a way to determine how much something weighs, what the quantity is, and therefore it's also a way to delineate. But when it comes to arayot, in some ways, that is an artificial imposition of guidelines or defined delineations, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu defines what is and what is not considered to be arayot. On the other hand, when it comes to measurements, the essence of a measurement is a delineation. And therefore, when one violates the delineation of measurements, they are, in a sense, violating an objective limitation or delineation. When it comes to arayot, yes, they are violating a framework, but that is an imposed framework. And that's why the violation of a sin with regards to weights is more severe than that by arayot. How do you know that the terminology or ele is something that is severe, difficult? Because the pasuk says, "Dichtiv in Yechezkel that ele haaretz lakach." He took the strong men, the great ones, the big ones from the land. So over there, you see the word ele refers to those that are hardened and strong. And so to over here, the term el or ele tells us that there's a certain severity to the violation of these isurim. So the Gemara then asks, gabe arayot, nami aktiv ele. The word el is not the only terminology that is used by arayot, etatoe evota el, because at the end of the parsha, it also says, kol asher yaseh mikol ha-toivot ha-ele v'nichritu. So the word ele is also used by arayot. So then how can you then make this distinction between arayot and midot if they both have the term ele over here? Elohao le-me'ute midot mi-karet. That is to come to teach you that midot don't have a din of karet. Now, as the Rashbam points out over here, there's not necessarily a mechanism for learning that. You have ele and both of them. That would make it a gezeirah shava. But a person's not allowed to make up a gezeirah shava by himself. So if you don't have a mesorah for it, we wouldn't make such a gezeirah shava. So that can't be the havamina as to why you would get karet by midot. The other possibility is it's a kal v'chomer. If you get karet by arayot, then certainly you should get karet by midot. Because we're going to see in a second that even though midot might be more severe than arayot, there might be also a difference where that's not as clear that the midot are more severe because of the ability to do tshuva by arayot. And so then again, you can't make a kal v'chomer from one to the other. And therefore, the chiyuv karet cannot be extrapolated from arayot to midot. So then what would have been the havamina? The way the Rashbam phrased it is because both of them are called toevot. And so your havamina would be that the when it says by the arayot, kol asher yaseh mikol ha-toevot ha-ele v'nichritu, similarly, when the midot or avel b'midot is called the toevot, you would have thought it's subsumed in that posuk of toevot. And therefore you would have a chiyuv karet by midot from that association of them being included under the rubric of toevot. And what the word ele comes along to teach you is that ele is a miut to say that by arayot there is karet, by midot there is no karet. So Gemara says, wait a minute, if by arayot there is a chiyuv karet and by midot there is not, then elamayot fayu. Then why is it that you're telling me that midot are more severe than arayot? Arayot are subject to a chiyuv karet, whereas midot are not. Because the haltam efshar b'tshuva, v'halcha lo efshar b'tshuva. The big difference is that over there by arayot, you have the possibility of tshuva. Over here by midot, you don't have the possibility of tshuva. That might stem from the etzem difference between them, which is that arayot that involve a karet, a person takes more seriously, and therefore they do tshuva. Midot, which don't have a karet associated with them, only an isur, people don't take as seriously, and therefore they don't do tshuva. But most explain here that there's a more fundamental difference, which is a practical problem. That when you steal from individuals, and you steal from the public at large, it's impossible then in the end to do tshuva, because you can't repay them. You can't give them back that which you stole from them. And even though the Gemara in Baba Kama tells us that one can do public works with the money, and in that way repay the individuals or the rabbin that they stole, the Baal Yad Tosafot over here note, V'avagav d'armin en yetzeb en tzachi rabim, b'kom agom lav tshuva mal yotohi. That's not a real tshuva. It's a way to, as best as you can, discharge your obligation. But in the end, that's not a fulfillment of getting back to the individuals what you took from them. And Tosafot Divrei Matzko D'Tani, back on Lamed Hei Amud Bet, said the same thing there with regards to repayment through doing public works, that is not a full-fledged accomplishment of one obligation to do tshuva. And the Rashbam brings the beautiful idea that one could always do tshuva, even for things like arayot, because of the pasuk from Yirmiyahu, shuvu banim shovavim, erpa mishuvotechem. And the context of that parak in Yirmiyahu is that Bnei Yisrael, in a sense, cheated on Hashem and were involved in an illicit relationship with Avodah Zarah. As the pasuk there says, Achein bagdai sham mireah, kein bagadem bi Beit Yisrael neum Hashem. So you see that there is such a concept of tshuva for arayot. The Rashbam adds that we know from the Gemara in Kretot and in Makot, that if a person gets malkot for the Isur that they violated, that exempts them from the chiyuv karet. So there is a way, minadin, to rectify the situation by arayot and to dissolve the chiyuv karet by arayot. But again, by midot, there's no way to create a rectification of the situation or have the individuals who you stole from be repaid. The Dalei Tosafot then ask, wait a minute, by arayot, we say over there that if a person has a mamzer born from arayot, that's called a me'uvat she'enu yechol litkon. That is a mistake that cannot be rectified. And from there it sounds like you can't do tshuva. So one possibility is to separate between arayot, where there is no mamzer born from it. Over there is the possibility of tshuva. In Ochanami, when you have arayot that involves a mamzer, then you have a problem that cannot be solved, or tshuva that cannot be done. On the other hand, he brings from the Rabbeinu Chaim, Afagav shu me'uvat lo yechol litkon, mikom makom efshar b'tshuva. So actually here there are two girsot, depending if you read it like the Bach, or you read it like the Mesorah de Shas, and they have actually large implications over here. One possibility is that by the case of Mamzer, even though the Mamzer is a mistake that cannot be rectified, you still have the possibility of doing tshuva. That seems to be the way that the Bach is reading the Girsayir and the Baal Yad Tosafot, which is that tshuva is possible for the arayot aspect of it. The mamzer aspect of it is a mistake that can be rectified because you've created something that's not going to go away. But as far as tshuva is concerned, you still have a right of tshuva and you can do tshuva for the arayot. The other Girsa, which seemingly is the way that the Mesorah de Shas reads it, is that there is no requirement of tshuva over there. The Kodesh Baruch Hu calls a mamzer muvat asher lo yochol litkon. It's a mistake that cannot be rectified. Therefore, there's no obligation on you to rectify it. There is no obligation of tshuva over there. And therefore, you're not doing tshuva because you're not commanded to do tshuva. On the other hand, by the case of theft and the misrepresenting your weights or your measurements, that over there is a requirement of tshuva, but there's a requirement that you can't fulfill because you can't do tshuva. So for those reasons, the Gemara sees the problem of midot being much more severe than the problem of arayot because of the ability to accomplish tshuva by arayot, which is something that you can't do by midot. The Gemara continues along in this vein and says, That stealing from lay people, from other parties, is more severe than stealing from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Meaning that's Mo'el, Mi'ilah, misappropriating Hekdesh, Shazek Dim Chet the Mi'ilah. In Parshat Vayikra, when it speaks about someone stealing from another party, over there it says, Nefesh Ki Techeta, Uma'ala Ma'al Ba'Hashem V'Kichesh Ba'Mito. So in the Pasuk expressed it, it says he sins, and then Ma'ala Ma'al. And then he creates the Mi'ilah Neged Hashem. On the other hand, when it comes to the case of Mi'ilah, meaning stealing from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, over there it says, Kitim Omal Vechata Bishkaga, when you misappropriate, and then you have done a Mi'ilah. So the Chet only comes after the Mi'ilah. And what is noted over here by the Rishbam and many of the Rishonim, is that when you violate Gezel, when you steal from a lay person, the theft itself is the Isur. Whereas when it comes to Hekdesh, you're only considered to be a misappropriator of Hekdesh, a Moab Hekdesh, after either you get Hana from it, or you're Pogame, you ruin it or destroy it in some way. The difference being that, when you're talking about Hekdesh, that's owned by a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Kodesh Baruch Hu is everywhere, and his ownership extends everywhere. So in order to steal from a Kodesh Baruch Hu, you can't simply just take it. You have to then misappropriate it to your benefit, either by getting Hana from it, or destroying it in some way. On the other hand, when you steal from an individual has defined ownership. And if you take it out of his possession, then immediately you have stolen from him. And that's why the Pasuk by the Hedyot expresses it as a Chet, and then Ma'al Ma'al Bashem. At first you have sinned right away. As soon as you take it, you have violated the Isur of Gezel. And then, of course, you have then been an affront to Hashem, but the Isur, the Chet, happens first. Then by Mi'ilah, you have to be Ma'al Ma'al Bashem. You have to be Bugeid in some way, Neged Hashem, by taking action, and only then do you become a Choteh. So there's a delayed aspect of Chet, but the main drasha that is being noted over here is that Chet by a Hedyot comes first, and it's mentioned first in the Pasuk before the Mi'ilah. Whereas the Mi'ilah by the Hekdesh is mentioned first, and then only then a Chet. And so you see that the severity of stealing from lay people is greater than stealing from a Kodesh Baruch Hu. Rama Rabbi Levi, Boresh, Lankum Midat, Kodesh Baruch Hu, Midat Pasar Badam. That the ways of Hashem are different than the ways of man. Kodesh Baruch Hu, Berech et Yisrael Besri Mishtaim, Vikilan Bishmoneh, that a Kodesh Baruch Hu gave them Brachot with 22, and cursed them with 8. Birchan Besri Mishtaim, this is from the beginning of the Tochacha in Parshat Bechukotai, where it starts off with the positive aspects, which is, maybe im Bechukotai Teleichu, ad Komimiyut, which is the section that involves the Bracha, and it's a Sri Mishtaim because the first letter is im Aleph, and the last letter is Komimiyut, is a Tuf. Means Aleph ad Tuf is the 22 letters of the Aleph Bet. That is what the Bracha is associated with. Bekilalan Bishmonet. And then he cursed them with 8, because it says, Ve'im bechukotai tim asu. So there it starts with a vav. Ad ve'etz chukotai ga'ala nafsham. And then the tocha ends with a mem. So it's from the letter vav until mem, which is 8 letters. And so therefore, with only 8 letters, does he curse B'nai Yisrael. On the other hand, Ilam Moshe Rabbeinu, when it deals with the tochacha, in Sefer Dvarim, in Parshat Ki Tavo, it says, Birchan Bishmone, he gave the Brocha with 8, Bikilan Beshri Mishtaim, and he cursed them with 22. Birchan Bishmone, he blessed them with 8, because it says, Vayayim Shamoa Tishma, if you listen to the words of Hashem, and you do what you're supposed to do, Vad La'avdam. So there he begins with a Vav, and ends with the Mem, which is the 8 letters, Bikilan Beshri Mishtaim, and then the Klalot, again, in Kitabo, there are 98 klalot, and in Bechukotai, there are 49. So we're obviously not speaking about the number of klalot, but rather the letters that encompass them. By the case of the klala, it says, V'haya im lo tishma b'kol Hashem. You don't listen to what Hashem tells you. And then it ends with V'ein koneh. So it starts with a vav, and ends with a hey. So vav, all the way around, if you came on a circle and came back to hey, you've used up all the letters of the alphabet, all the 22 letters of the alphabet. Now, in general, when you speak about the 22 letters of the alphabet, it usually implies a certain amount of shleimut, completion, and delineation. So when it comes to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he uses 22 letters for the bracha. Because by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Midah Tovah exceeds the Midat Apuraniyot. That we already learned from the language that's used in the Aseret HaDibrot. And similarly over here, Hashem gives the bracha with 22. That's what Hashem is trying to bestow upon us. And the klala is only to get us to the bracha, or to rectify our ways to get to the bracha. Therefore, only gives that with 8. On the other hand, for human beings, it's the other way around. Human beings are more naturally disposed to do bad or negative towards others. And therefore, the 22 letters encompass the klala, whereas the 8 letters encompass the bracha, which is not the natural way that people are towards each other, or the inherent nature of the individual to bestow good upon others. Or, in other words, another way to explain it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is identified with bracha. Hashem's creation of the world and what he wants to do in the world is all Midat HaChesed, and all HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants to do is bestow goodness on the world. And therefore, bracha and HaKadosh Baruch Hu are one and the same, or something that is in the nature of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Whereas klala is the opposite of that, and therefore it's distanced. On the other hand, for human beings who are mortal and have animalistic drive to them, they are more associated with klala than they are with bracha, because of the destructive nature of the human desire. Therefore, they're closer to being associated with klala than bracha. And obviously the challenge for the individual is to reverse that. Is that the person should become a bestower of bracha, and the person should become more identified with bracha, and so therefore we strive or aspire to being the bracha of 22 and not the klala of 22. Over here there is a very interesting Balei HaTosafot that is paralleled by a Balei HaTosafot in Masechet Megillah with regards to the requirement that one read the klalot of Sefer Vayikra before Shavuot, and that one read the klalot of Sefer Devarim before Rosh Hashanah. The idea being that Shitamu Shana v'kilulotah, that the year should end with its klalot, I mean that should be behind us, and the new year should begin with a bracha. So like Shavuot, which is Rosh Hashanah Peirot, and Rosh Hashanah, which is Rosh Hashanah Ledin, so therefore, we want to try to get the klalot done before the Rosh Hashanah. That's what the Gemara Megillah suggests. The Balei Tosafot say that our practice is not that way. We actually put in an additional parsha between the klalot and those holidays. We read Bamidbar before Shavuot, and we read Nitzavim before Rosh Hashanah. The Balei Tosafot say the reason we do that is to create a buffer between the klalot and the beginning of the new year. We don't just want to end the previous year with the bad stuff behind us, but we also want to end on a high note. And so therefore we don't want to end on the klalot. We already want to move on to something good before we complete the year. He says that when it comes to a year in which there are 2 Shabbatot between Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, so therefore you'd have to lay 2 Parshiot. We end up laying on Shabbat Shuvah, Parshat Vayelech. And the Shabbat between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, we lay Parshat Hazinu. So Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon suggests the reason behind splitting up Nitzavim Vayelech into 2 Parshiot, even though they're tiny, and leaving Matot Maseh together, even though they're massive Parshiot, is in order to facilitate this, which is that the Klalot be finished before the new year, which is that the beginning of Nitzavim continues the Klalot, and therefore we want to finish them up before Rosh Hashanah. And that's why we lay in Kitavo and Nitzavim before Rosh Hashanah in order to get the Klalot out of the way. The Balei Tosafot from our Gemara prove over here that the Klalot end at Ein Koneh, which is at the end of Parshat Kitavo and not in Parshat Nitzavim. The Gemara doesn't view Parshat Nitzavim as being a part and parcel of the Klalot. Therefore, he rejects the reasoning of the Rabbeinu Nissim Gaon as to why we read Nitzavim before Rosh Hashanah, not to get all the klalot out of the way, but rather for the reason that the Balei Tosafot suggested, which is it creates a buffer between the klalot and the end of the year. And he uses our Gemara as a proof to that position, and also as an aside explains why we simply do something that is illogical, which is that we end up pairing very large parshiot together, making them into double parshiot, and up dividing up very small parshiot into 2 smaller components. And even though that seems illogical, the reason we're doing it is in order to have Bamidbar fall out before Shavuot, and to have Nitzavim fall out before Rosh Hashanah. Okay, we're going to stop here at the two dots on the top of Pei Tet, Amud Aleph.